Here, you want to come up and explain the base bill to us? Oh, I take that back. We don't have a quorum. I can't open a work session. I can open it. We can't vote, right? It's open. That's right. Please talk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a member of the committee. Gary Bauer with the Oregon Telecommunications Association. Senate Bill 622, which was originally brought to you on behalf of 11 telephone cooperatives that provide telephone service in Oregon. What they are interested in was bringing some of the definitions of telecommunications utility up to date, specifically those that currently relate back to the definition in ORS 759005. I provided an attachment that lists all of the sections of the bill and what they would do. We have also asked for a set of amendments, which I think are the dash fours, if I recall. What that will do is only amend the sections that specifically relate to 759005 and not address statutes that generically use the definition of telecommunications utility. Again, the reason for this is that over the years, as cooperatives have participated in the process, I think generically folks have just included them as a utility. They are not included as a utility in the definition of 759005, and that's the reason for basically they've been covered and treated under those statutes by various organizations, including cities and counties, for example. And that would just clarify that they would be included in that.
Do we have your dash fours or?
You should have, Mr. Chair. They were over on the table earlier.
Oh, okay. Oh, yes, they're there. Okay. Continue.
Only other comment is I do know it has a wonderful relating clause based on the number of amendments that are out over there. As you go through this process, we would appreciate if at least the original concepts are somehow embodied in the bill as you go forward. And also I would like to talk to you about finding other relating clauses. Questions?
Is there any opposition to the original bill?
Mr. Chair, that's my knowledge. There is no opposition. There was no opposition in the Senate. Let me make, if I could, one quick comment on that. I did discuss this with the League of Oregon Cities. They have some concerns about whether this would change anything. The intent is not to change how people operate today. It will clarify that franchise statutes, for example, do apply to telephone cooperatives, and I believe the League of Oregon Cities is comfortable with that. We agreed to put that on the record. Thank you.
For the record, Oregon League representative is nodding in the affirmative.
Thank
Mike, you want to come up with Tom? We'll have dueling amendments here. Mike's are dash ones, Tom's are the dash threes. Mike, can I go first?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Wages Cable Telecommunications Association, a trade association of Oregon cable companies. And we are offering the Dash 1s to Symbol 622, and Mr. O'Connor may have, I'm not sure if they're twos or threes, but I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, how you would like to proceed. I would be happy to...
5 minutes.
Sure, thank you.
Say your piece.
I can do that. What we are attempting to do is... eighth term level, the playing field, that that's what we're doing in the Dash 1 amendments. And basically it provides for a municipality that is in the telecommunications business, providing telecommunications services on a retail basis and competing with a private provider. The concept is fairly straightforward, that their direct and indirect costs are included in their cost of service. And we are doing this, we think, for good public policy reasons. It's good to see you over there, Representative Rosenbaum, Representative King. The reason we're doing this is because in terms of the incremental cost that a city would have in providing telecommunications services as an entity would be less than if they were a private party, private company, corporation, providing telecommunications services. The city of Tacoma is getting in the telecommunications business, and recently in a conference they said that our incremental costs are not substantially higher than we thought they would be because we already are in the electric business and we can, if you will, utilize dollars from that business for us to get into the telecommunications business. And we've talked about this before, but let me, if I may, just point out some scenarios to you that I think are unfair. First of all, a municipality would regulate a telecommunications private entity through a franchise. So they are, in a sense, they are the regulator and the competitor. They're almost the player and the umpire, if you will. And let me talk about some of the issues that can come up. And this is why we think the indirect cost should be included. Take the example of someone who calls the electric department and says, I'd like to be provided electric service, power service. The city is in that particular business. After they've made their order, the next thing the city might say is, the person that answered the phone, would you like cable TV service? Telephone service, whatever. That would be the indirect costs of providing those services. And we believe that those costs should be associated with the telecommunications side of the ledger as opposed to the electric side of the ledger. Billing services would be the same situation. Marketing would be the same situation where you have people and you have service and supplies that provide the same service. And so this would require that the municipality allocate their indirect costs into their costs. We should know their direct costs, providing the facilities, the head in, the equipment, those would be all of their direct costs that would, from an accounting standpoint, be able to find in their books. But the indirect costs are the concerns that we have. Now let me say that, just to give you an idea why we have some concerns, this is a report that was provided through two professors at the University of Denver. It's called Cost Benefits and Long-Term Sustainability of Municipal Cable Television Overbills. And this is one of their conclusions. And this is regarding, again, cable companies owned and operated by a city. This is quote on page 3. The only reason these enterprises are solvent is because these municipal power companies are able to, one, subsidize operating expenses and capital expenditures, two, provide interest-free loans to the cable operation, and or levy taxes on the community to support the cable operation. Absent these municipal power companies' capabilities, along with both their tax-free status and their access to lower cost of capital, None of these enterprises could be sustained over the long run in a competitive marketplace. So we're not saying that these municipalities ought not be in the business. But we do believe there needs to be a floor, if you will, so there isn't a predatory pricing. We think these are good amendments. They are fair from the standpoint of what the city and municipality has to do on an accounting basis, and we think they are in the public interest. I've looked at Mr. O'Connor's amendments, and basically, I think they basically would retain current law, and I don't think they do anything for anybody, and I would suggest that if you look favorably toward them, they really don't provide any additional information from the standpoint of the consumer or the competitor. Mr. Chair, I thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Are there any questions? Thank you. Tom?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom O'Connor, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. Thank you for inviting me up. We would oppose the Cable Association amendments that Mr. Dewey has made reference to and offer instead as our alternative the Dash 3 amendments, which I think are in your packet. Just briefly describing those, recognizing that that municipal telecommunications providers may have some unique circumstances. What we have proposed would say in Section 3 that any publicly owned service provider, the state or any other publicly owned provider, that has any franchise or regulatory authority over other provider of telecommunications service would have to exercise that franchise in a competitively neutral and non-discriminatory manner consistent with the Federal Telecommunications Act and the Federal Cable Act. It also says that in Section 3, recognizing a concern that has been raised, that any municipality providing telecommunications service may not use telecommunications franchise revenues to operate or subsidize, if you will, the telecommunications or cable side of the operation. And in Section 4, it requires us to prepare, maintain distinct accounting records, separate and distinct accounting records relating to the telecommunications service, showing the full costs associated with providing that service, and all costs, actually, the language speaks on line 15, to all costs actually incurred in providing the service. And finally, and also in that section, it says that if we are, as municipalities, in compliance with full compliance with local budget law, which sets out the procedures for how municipal funds are handled with separate identifiable funds and so on, that we would be deemed to be in compliance with this section, because we don't want to be whipsawed between two different sets of statutes. And finally, in Section 5, it says that we shall comply with all applicable portions of the open meetings law. Let me just say a couple of things in response to some of the concerns that, or some of the comments that Mr. Dewey's raised. The way that we intend to, the way that we will be operating and would operate under this section, on indirect costs, for example, like any other part of the municipal operation dealing with utilities, there's usually a central billing system at the city, and the different departments, whether it's water, sewer, electric, or in this case telecommunications, charge the costs are charged the costs of providing those billing services to each of the departments. So those costs are included and would be verified under local budget law, would be verified in the budget that's adopted every year by the municipality, that's Mike's people or anybody else can participate in those processes. As you well know, there's a requirement for a budget advisory committee that goes through this whole process, that lays all that out in public, and the opportunity for comment and participation in that process. I'd say one other thing, I guess, in conclusion. There's been a lot of talk here about well, there'd be some unfair advantage. I guess what's good for the goose might be good for the gander. We are operating in a totally open environment of the public records and open meetings law. On the other hand, some of the folks involved in the cable and telecommunications business that would supposedly be competing with us are not. There is no way that we would know, for example, as a public, how money is moved between TCI, for example, on the cable side, TCI at home, or for that many any of the other parts of the business. And I guess maybe many of you received the same coupon that I did in the mail the other day, which offers me all at once. I get at home, I get a free movie, and I also get something about phone service. So that's all being bundled on the other side, and contrary to our situation, there's no requirement for public accountability or open records as it goes through that.
You need to send that in for the
But it restricts my internet service provider, so I'm not sure I want to do it.
Question?
That concludes my... Yeah, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Tom.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks. Mr. O'Connor, could you respond to Mr. Dewey's comment on your amendment that it just restates what the law requires right now and so is unnecessary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, we have, in doing the amendment, tried to make sure that we clarified what sections apply to us and how they do. I mean, yes, we are required right now under local budget law to operate in the manner that I described. We believe that the Telecommunications Act requires us to operate in a fair and non-discriminatory manner. I guess my response to that was that when we raised these issues, or when these issues were raised in previous discussions, and we talked about those requirements at the federal level and the local level, some people said to us, well, it's not in the bill. It's not in, you know, it's not separately identified. So what we've tried to do here with these amendments is offer a fair and responsible mechanism to ensure that these requirements do apply to us and that we do operate in a fair and non-discriminatory manner.
Thank you.
Tom.
If I may add, Representative Deckert and Representative Rosenbaum, which is the current federal law.
Tom, I guess my question is, in terms of the cross-subsidy and eminent domain, is what is the rationale for not having some sort of language, and would it preclude a municipality from making the investment if we did have statutory language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Deckert, eminent domain, frankly, it hasn't been raised on this issue lately. I suppose we could work something up. Contrary to some of the other folks that are operating in this telecommunications cable industry, we have a PUC certificate, as I mentioned, and I can't believe that we could do anything if we try to do eminent domain that certificate wouldn't get yanked in a heartbeat. So, I mean, if somebody wanted to do something with that language, we could work with them. It's not an issue for them as far as we're concerned.
Cross-subsidy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Deckert, our response to that is that what we've tried to lay out here is to avoid is an alternative that lays the way we do business out in front of the public for everybody to see, requires us to fully account for how we handle those monies, and the regulatory agency in terms of the PUC and our local elected officials are in place to handle that. We would oppose additional pricing, diving down into the pricing of our services at this point without any showing, as near as we can tell, of abuse on our part, particularly, as I mentioned before, when these other folks have no requirements, as far as I know, on them, that they can't move money around between those categories of PCI at home and PCI able and whatever.
How would
so
you
we
answer?
Just don't feel it's necessary at this point, and that's why we've tried to lay out an alternative.
If I may, Representative Hill and Representative Deckard, I think the key here is you have an entity that is your regulator and your competitor, and that's the difference here. Private companies compete with private companies, and whoever can get the best capital deal, you can get the best capital deal. We go back to, unfortunately, to the city of Ashland that wants to be in the cable business, and you try and follow the money, and they talked about issuing revenue bonds. We kind of waited for that, and instead it was basically the cable side borrowing money from the electric side, is what we found out later when somebody started to ask those questions. So we'd like to have that in the open. We think it makes a lot of sense. The information, the amendments that I bring to you are not original. My counterpart in Georgia and the Municipality League reached an accord on those amendments that we kind of borrowed from. But kind of the Oregon model, but it's the same sort of process with pricing and direct pricing and indirect pricing. But I don't think the good for the deuce for the ender is a good argument here, because these are private companies, even private companies. The difference is that they want to show their cost of providing service incrementally. We would like to see their entire cost be in their prices. For example, property taxes. They don't pay property taxes, so they wouldn't impute those in. We think they should.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay. Jason, do you want to run us through colleagues? There's Representative King. Representative King, do you want to introduce your dash twos and step the committee through those?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Al King, District 44. And I'm introducing the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 622. The purpose of that is to allow up to $200 million of industrial development revenue bonds for the purposes of telecommunications infrastructure development in the state. This would in no way impact the bond ratings of the state of Oregon, because this would only be secured by the assets that are purchased for the purposes of providing that service, and the bonds would be paid off from the revenues generated from that service. I did discuss this with the Treasurer's Office. It's actually a pretty exciting concept. The bonds, if they are used by a local government, i.e., for example, a city or a county, an industrial park, any local government, then the bonds would be tax exempt. However, if it was a private company that was using the proceeds from these bonds, then the bonds would become taxable bonds. And at that point, for most of the companies that would be involved in providing telecommunications infrastructure, that would not be very effective for them. They can issue commercial paper that's taxable at a lower cost in terms of the issuance, and add or perhaps even better in terms of interest rates as well. So this really wouldn't be something that helps like a US West or a GTE of any significance. But it could help an industrial park. And so we don't know all the applications, but it does put a tool on the shelf so that if for some reason some community is underserviced, there is a company that would like to come to town, they would like to pay their bills, but there's no infrastructure in sight. This gives a tool to be able to, you know, to respond to that. So hopefully I've given you an explanation.
Thank you. Are there any questions on the next two amendments?
Thank you.
Thank you. I guess it might help if I say that a revenue bond is paid for only by the interest from the revenue of the project, not by the state, as versus a general obligation bond, which we're more familiar with, which would have the full faith and credit of the state behind it, which this is not.
Thank you. Jason, now, could you step us through the dash 5 amendments? Colleagues before you, they have a section-by-section analysis prepared by Mr. Cody. And we will start with a highlight of those, and then we'll start taking testimony on the dash 5s.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'll try to hit the major points of the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 622. Section 44 provides some basic definitions. Section 45 covers electing telecommunications carriers and states that they shall be subject to infrastructure investment and price regulation requirements. These are electing telecommunications carriers. They shall not be subject to any other rate regulation. They shall establish a telecommunications infrastructure account and commit over a four-year period to its telecommunications infrastructure account amounts totaling 20% of its gross regulated interstate revenue. And that's broken out. 30% should be credited on the date of election, 30% on the same date of the following year, and then 20% each of the following 2 years. The Economic Development Commission approves the TIA investment plans. The carrier must spend all of the monies in that account. In Section 46, alternative regulation, price caps, and price floors for basic and other telecommunications services, the carrier may opt out of rate of return regulation and in return be subject to price cap regulation. Also, they must meet specific service quality standards and make payments to the state to support use and deployment of advanced telecommunications services. Basic telephone service shall be subject to regulation by the PUC. Every retail telecommunications service regulated by the PUC or that other than basic shall be the maximum price a telecommunications carrier may charge for that service. Section 47 covers wholesale transactions. Section 48 deals with the rate case. Any pending rate case as of January 1, 1999 is subject to a court judgment or negotiated settlement. Rates as a result of a final judgment. If a telecommunications carrier is to make a refund to a consumer, it shall do so in a manner prescribed by the PUC. Any rate proceeding brought about after January 1, 1999 shall be dismissed if the telecommunications carrier elects within the latter of 90 days of commencement of the proceeding or 90 days of the effective date of this 1999 Act. Section 49 deals with the Universal Service Fund. The PUC shall establish and implement a competitively neutral, non-discriminatory Universal Service Fund within 12 months of the effective date of the Act or within 6 months of a FCC ruling. The PUC shall establish a statewide benchmark rate for basic telephone service, taking into account additional assistance provided to low-income customers through the Residential Service Protection Plan. Eligible telecommunications carriers shall receive support from the federal and state program to offset the difference between the actual cost for providing that service and the state benchmark rate. The PUC shall also establish a process for making the transition from implicit support for basic telephone service to the explicit support from the Universal Service Fund. This fund shall be a surcharge on the sale of all retail telecommunications services sold in the state. All monies in the Universal Service Fund are continuously appropriated to the PUC, and retail telecommunications service includes radio communications, radio paging, communications, mobile radio, personal communications, or cellular communications services. the service quality standards apply to every telecommunications carrier on a non-discriminatory basis. This is Section 50. Minimum standards shall relate to specific customer impact indices. The PUC may set additional target objectives for each measurement of service quality. The PUC may also require a telecommunications carrier not meeting the objective to submit a plan for doing so. If the telecommunications carrier doesn't meet goals within 6 months as outlined in their plan, penalties should be assessed proportionate to the severity of any violation by the PUC. Section 51 deals with those penalties for not meeting service quality standards. And they shall be prorated for each electing telecommunications carrier based on its size relative to the largest telecommunications carrier. The various service quality standards that are in Section 51 concern held orders with a penalty of $20,000 per held order per quarter if 80% of the standard is not achieved. The maximum penalty would be $2.5 million per year. Held orders over 30 days, the penalty would be $10,000 per held order in excess of the standard, the maximum of $500,000 per year. A trouble report rate, a penalty of $25,000 per wire center per month with a maximum of $2 million per year. Network blockage with a penalty of $10,000 per wire center per month with a maximum of $2 million per year. Trouble reports cleared, a penalty of $15,000 per month and a maximum of $200,000 per year. Repair center access, penalty is $15,000 per month, maximum is $150,000 per year. And finally, sales office access, a penalty can be assessed of $15,000 per month and $150,000 per year. Penalties shall be paid as credits to the telecommunications carrier's customers or directed by the PUC to target specific issues of service quality. Section 52 deals with telecommunications infrastructure account projects. The Economic Development Commission shall approve these plans funded by a telecommunications carrier individual telecommunications infrastructure account. The Connecting Communities Advisory Board is established within the Economic Development Commission and is charged with reviewing and making recommendations for these projects to the Economic Development Commission. Section 53, Connecting Oregon Communities Fund, is established, and within it, two accounts are also established to support education and public access to advanced telecommunications services. The first one, the school technology account, is created to improve access to advanced telecommunications services for public schools, K through 12, and has a priority to receive the $25 million for each of the 2 years beginning year 2000 and then again in 2001. The public access account is created to improve access to advanced telecommunications services for public higher education, public libraries, and rural health care providers. If no other funding source is secured, $3.25 million shall be transferred to the Department of Higher Education for each of 2 years beginning in the year 2000 and then again in 2001 to fund the Oregon Wide Area Network Project. Section 54 deals with funding for the Oregon Public Education Network, or OPEN. It transfers from the school technology account to the DOE 9600 for each school facility lacking a local area network for the purpose of providing a LAN and associated equipment. It also transfers from this account to the DOE for each educational school district the following monies for OPEN: $1.5 million for recurring costs of internet bandwidth, $500,000 for the purchase of telecommunications equipment, $250,000 for an online film and video server pilot project to digitize and electronically distribute video content. It also transfers $5,400 for each eligible school facility for the purpose of distribution to these districts for recurring costs of telecommunications connectivity, and $7.1 million for the purpose of purchasing a two-way interactive distance education systems for each public high school and for each ESD. Section 55, 56, and 57 deal with the distribution of funds to K through 12 for the projects just described. Section 58 describes the PUC's ability to assess penalties. It is now authorized to assess a $50,000 penalty against a public utility or telecommunications utility for each violation. Section 59 repeals Section 51, January 1, year 2004, and Section 60 declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you, Jason. Larry, do you want to come up? Colleagues, if they have any technical questions, Chris Green is here from Legislative Council. We'll impose upon him to, if you have any technical questions related to the structure of the Dash 5 amendments, he can address those issues for you. Also, it's not my intent to confuse, but I also have the Dash 6 amendments here. And what the difference between the Dash 6 and the Dash 5s is the Dash 6 amendments contain language that's related to the Universal Service Fund that allows wireless companies to opt in to the Universal Service Fund rather than in the Dash 5s they have the ability to opt out. I'm confident that Mr. Kosasan and Mr. Glassman have worked the committee over so you understand the issue. But that's the difference between the Dash 5s and the Dash 6s, and we'll get that distributed out. But for this purposes, we'll talk about the Dash 5s today, but that's the only technical change between the Dash 6s and the Dash 5. Larry, please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Larry Huss. I'm Vice President for U.S. West Oregon. And Jason, I think I gave you my copy of the bill at the end of that stack. I may need it for that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 622 now contains the major components of Senate Bill 142, as well as some rather significant changes that have come to pass since the beginning of the consideration of the bill. Discussions that have been held both with the governor's office and with the Joan Smith of the Public Utility Commission. And let me say at the outset that Joan Smith represented herself, not the commission, in this matter. She made it clear that she did not speak on behalf of the commission as we discussed the issues surrounding it. And while we've had a number of discussions with the governor's office, I don't believe that the governor's office has committed either for or against the bill or the amendments that are contained in Bill 622. The major elements of the bill as introduced by the Rural Coalition and supported by U.S. West remain intact. They are mandatory investment in advanced telecommunications infrastructure for rural Oregon, a mandatory implementation of a state universal service fund to move from current implicit subsidies to explicit subsidies funded on a competitively neutral basis, and the elimination of rate of return regulation. What has been added as a part of these discussions and are contained in the Dash 5 amendments are four significant propositions. The first is to reimpose the price caps on all retail services, which is consistent with the bill as originally introduced in the Senate and as intended by the sponsors and by U.S. West. Second, there is now a three-step phase-in for the Universal Service Fund to provide for a transition mechanism. So the support mechanism will kick in one-third segments each 2 years, commencing with the implementation of the fund. There is now a service quality matrix with mandatory penalties which will benefit customers rather than the general fund. The governor's office had suggested the Colorado matrix as a statutory requirement. We reviewed it and found that to be acceptable. In fact, what we have come up with in the matrix is much stricter standards than are contained in the service quality matrix that has been adopted by Colorado. Although the service quality standards in the matrix are marginally lower than current rules, and there is a good reason for that. Under current rules, the Commission has administered the standards contained in those rules as targets. And under their administration as targets, if you vary from meeting the rules, they watch first for trends. If it's just an aberration, nothing is done or said. If there is a pattern, they call you in. If there is a continuing decline in it or a failure to remedy it and move it back in the right direction, then the Commission will ask you to submit a plan. And the plan itself then becomes the vehicle for ensuring that there is greater service quality. Violations of the rules do not automatically result in fines. Under the matrix that is included in the system or in the bill currently, in fact, violations do result in fines. There is no watching for trends, there is no discussion, there is no submission of a plan for compliance. If you miss the minimum standards, which are contained in the matrix, you in fact incur a fine, and that fine is totaled up and then utilized at the end of the year in the form of bill credits or refunds to customers, as opposed to going into the state general fund, which is where most fines go.
Larry, let me jump in there just for a second. So from a practical sense, in terms of if you miss these targets and you are fined, as opposed to what it currently happens today, from a practical sense, in terms of if you miss a target today, what is the time frame before some action or something occurs that is tangible under the present system, as opposed to looking at the matrix today that's presented here, and what would be a tangible result of that?
Well, it's difficult to say. I think it in part it probably depends on the degree by which you miss the standard. The process involves, if the Commission goes so far as to try and invoke the fines under the current law, there is a process in which they go through a show cause proceedings. They have to have a hearing, make a determination that you have violated the standards without cause, and then they take that to court to impose the fines, and the court makes the determination as to the level of the fines. That process could take anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months. In this instance, it just happens automatically at the end of each quarter. There is a review of the records or reports that the electing utility would provide the Commission, and a determination, mathematical determination, as to whether you have or have not met the standards, and if you have not met the standards, how far you've missed them, and then add up consistent with the matrix, and a determination is made, and that's what they're going to take. The final element is that there has been a redistribution of the funds that would be provided by the electing carrier. In U.S. West case, the funds that would be provided are about $120 million spread over 4 years. And you will see that there are two different ways that is administered. For utilities, or for telecommunications utilities that have in excess of 1 million access lines, then we must provide 20% over 4 years, but it's front-end loaded. So we have to provide 6% of our gross intrastate revenues for the first 2 years and 4% of the latter 2 years. Of that amount, the first $25 million in each, or I'm sorry, 70% of that amount is provided to the educational fund, and 30% is provided to the rural infrastructure fund in the first 2 years, and in the latter 2 years, 100% of it is provided to the rural infrastructure fund. The first 2 years, the first $25 million of each year goes into a technical assistance fund for K-12 education. The remainder is distributed through the language you see in the bill. For all other utilities that would elect under it, the requirement is 5% per year, each year for 4 years, and the division is 60% for rural infrastructure and 40% for educational needs. In the end, both the large utilities and smaller utilities wind up with a 60-40 split. Ours is just simply front-end loaded.
Sarah, let me jump in there. The way this is structured, have you looked in terms of the investment that would be required by U.S. West to meet the obligations? I mean, because I know in terms of U.S. West presently has a contract with the state to deliver frame services.
Right.
With the part of the consortium delivering those services. In terms of to meet the needs and requirements of this bill, it's those rural areas that you do serve, in terms of do you foresee investment to meet those obligations?
Yes. I think one of the intentions of the expenditure of the $25 million is to ensure that every school has connectivity at a T1 capacity. That would require further distribution of facilities in order to meet that commitment. I think that there are, Mr. Chairman, you're going to have to help me with it. There are a number of schools that currently do not have T1 capacity.
141.
And so there would have to be further deployment of facilities and capacity.
And as for the component in terms of the 220 connections to the video conferencing, I'm not sure in terms of what, whether that's a frame or just a clear channel or whatever, in terms of that would be required to be competitively bid.
Right.
In terms of if that's everywhere in the state. So,
that's correct.
So someone is going to, but most likely a consortium or somebody is going to, or a single entity, I guess.
Yeah, there'll probably be two stages to the bid, one to buy the equipment, the other one to provide the connectivity. And since nobody has a statewide system, such as every community, undoubtedly there will be several consortiums that will bid for the provision of that service in order to be able to provide it to all high schools throughout the state of Oregon. Those are the major changes that come about with the amendments that are contained in Senate Bill 622. U.S. West continues to support the concepts and supports the amendments that have been offered in Senate Bill 622. And I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Larry, I think I missed your point about why it makes sense to have loosened the standards below what they are right now under this proposal?
The current standards are not administered in a fashion in which they result in automatic fines. They are targets. They are the definitive of security of service. And the commission administers them in a fashion that urges the telecommunications utilities to achieve those standards. If you miss those standards, you don't necessarily take a fine. The commission administers it in a fashion that says, if you miss it once, we notice it. If there is a trend in missing it, we want you to come in and talk to us. If it's indicative of service quality worsening, then we want a plan for you to fix it. And as a part of the plan, we want mileposts and penalties that come along with it. If we can't resolve it in that form of administration, then we'll go to court and exact fines from it. And so, as you will see in another part of the bill, there is a provision that requires the commission to impose minimum service quality standards on all carriers and then target standards, which I would presume would be the same as the target standards today. Below the minimum standards, they will have an exact finding authority. Above the minimum standards and below the target, they will utilize their authority to bring carriers in and ask them what's going on, submit plans to bring yourself back up towards the target, and so on and so forth.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Larry, how would you respond to the argument that an incumbent could use the, could tap the TIA account to use existing projects on their books and use the TIA funds to achieve that? I guess they're thus circumventing the intent of this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Deckard, no project can be credited against those accounts until OEDD signs off that this is an acceptable project. So there is no bootstrapping or self-help in this. If OEDD doesn't sign off, there's no credit against the account.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
So prospectively, what US West would do, would they would develop a list of projects that would be augmentations to the existing investment being made, take it to OEDD and get approval for these new projects, and then upon receiving approval would then commence to building the project.
Well, let me jump in there. There's a Oregon Connecting Communities Board, which is a subgroup. It's the OEDD Commission, not the department, that makes the determination. It's the commission who are making the determination. So there's a subgroup under the commission making the recommendations, establishing the rules, right? The commission establishes the rules, and then they work through the development group, and then it's the commission making the determination.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Deckard, in all probability, the administration of it won't start with U.S. West. Where it'll start with is the communities. As we have envisioned it in our discussions with the Rural Coalition who brings this bill forward, the work will begin at the grassroots. OEDD, in fact, will probably provide assistance to communities to help them identify their needs and their priorities. Those will be brought forward en masse, and then projects will be developed from those that the board, the advisory board, and the commission or the department must approve before they go forward. So we simply aren't going to be able to say this project and that project without OEDD sign off and without the advisory board sign off.
And it's your anticipation that the projects would be brought to you rather than internally, that the projects would be brought to you rather than they were internally designed?
From the inception, we have believed that this will be more of a grassroots process than a top-down project.
Could you pull your microphone closer?
Yes.
Any further questions? Larry, in terms of if you fail to live up to the obligations that are established by the OEDD and the Green Connecting Board, can you, for the record, tell us what happens?
If we fail to abide by the commitments made to the projects approved by OEDD, we forfeit the balance of the funds, and they will be moved from our accounts to the state accounts for use by the educational communities.
Well, rural health care,
yes.
Community colleges, higher ed,
K through 12, rural health.
Representative King?
I've got some concerns about authorizing opting out of the regulation, you know, and I can understand why the fines are below the targets, you know, as, you know, I think that's a logical statement. But on the other hand, it seems like there's room for the fine levels to become, you know, the bare minimum versus targets, and so, you know, there's some encouragement to say, you know, some minimal level above that is versus where targets are at currently. And so I'm wondering if there's either some process, lower level of fine, or that where we can, you know, try and maintain current level of quality is versus, you know, be open to a diminishing of quality level of service.
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, I'm not sure how we would do that. The thing that we are trying to avoid is to convert an existing system, which has some of the highest standards in the United States, to to a system in which there would be automatic fines. If there is a, if there is concern about that, I'd rather stay under the existing system and the existing fine levels and deal with the commission's current method of administration in which they would invite you in. We did this at the request of people who were concerned about service quality, and we think it's a reasonable compromise, but I don't want to put into place a system in which the current targets become the minimum standard.
And I understand, I agree with that, but I am uncomfortable with the prospect quote of lowering the targets, you know, without any kind of consequence, you know, associated with that.
Any further questions? Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Bob Jenks. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for this opportunity to come and testify. I am limiting my remarks only to the Dash 5 amendment. I guess to put in context what I want to say is I have to say that I'm disappointed with the Dash 5 amendment. I had talked with Regulator Joan Smith in the process to folks from the governor's office, and I was told that there would be several things that would be part of any compromise. The first would be the rate case was taken out. Not only was the rate case not taken out, but in the Dash 5, it's worse than it is in the last bill I saw. I was told that residential customers would be protected. They're not. I was told we would strengthen service quality. We'd actually weakened it. I was told the price caps would be adjustable and that there would be price caps on new services. Neither of those are the case. And what I want to do is sort of walk through a little bit about each of those. The first is, the rate case is still in the bill. The bill says that U.S. West will not owe any interest going forward through the rate case. There's two parts of the rate case. One is deciding on how much rates need to be reduced, and the second part of it is trying to determine who gets the reductions, what prices go down. We may be able to resolve the first one in a settlement. We may not. I'm always willing to roll up my sleeves as a small organization with a small staff. I prefer to settle things in settlements and go to testimony and hearings because I don't have the capability to do very well at that. So I'm willing to roll up my shirt sleeves and try to work that out. But under this bill, U.S. West would have the incentive to delay that. And if you don't delay the first part, delay the second part of an agreement on whose prices get reduced, because meanwhile they keep the money and it no longer accrues interest to go to the customers. That's the first part. That's been part of the bill. The second part that was added to this, though, is that if there's a settlement between the PUC and U.S. West on the rate case, that settlement is binding on all parties. I'm a party to the rate case. I'm a party to the court case, and I do not believe the legislature has the right to take away my right to appeal that. You can't make a decision by the PUC, an agreement between the PUC and U.S. West binding on CUB or AARP or other organizations. We retain our rights under Oregon law to appeal that decision to court. I can tell you don't win very many appeals of PUC decisions, but we clearly have that right if we believe that settlement doesn't conform with the law. So that's the problem with the rate case. The second issue is,
Representative Becker.
Bob, I just wanted, and forgive me if I've asked you this before, but I'm wrestling with just the questions that you raised in terms of the rate case.
Mm-hmm.
If the incumbent, well, in this case, U.S. West, goes into an alternative form of regulation and we have legislatively placed these price caps on, then I guess my mind says the rate case is, for all intents and purposes, over in the sense that we have placed price caps on, but would want to hear...
Well, the Dash 5 amendments say the prices for U.S. West would be the price caps would be adjusted for what comes out of the rate case. And so the price cap, if the rate case ends up, say the settlement of the rate case is a $75 million reduction, that means the price caps will come down by $75 million. But what this Dash 5 bill says is it will do that. But the longer U.S. West can delay those price caps going down, they get to keep that money. We think that gives an incentive to delay, to not negotiate for the rate spread, the rate design, who gets those reductions, even if we can agree on that number. It's a process to then figure out which price caps go down. The longer the company can delay, the more the company gets to keep that money and not refund it to customers. And customers neither, we could set up a situation under this bill where for 1 or 2 years, customers neither get the lower price caps that are defined in this bill, nor do they get a refund with interest of the money the company's over-earning during that time. We can debate whether the Attorney General's opinion, whether it's sort of legal or not to do that. I would argue that regardless of whether it's legal, it's bad policy to set in place saying the price caps are going to go down at the conclusion of this, but in the meantime, we're going to give the company an incentive to delay because they get to keep the money in the meantime. I think we won't see the benefits of the price reductions and the price caps if we set up those kinds of incentives. And I think the preferable approach is to do simply take out all language in reference to the rate case. I think if that happens, it gives U.S. West an incentive to settle it as quickly as possible. I know I have an incentive to settle it because customers don't get any money until we settle the rate case. So I think all parties have a great incentive to settle it, and I think once we can get the rate case out of the legislative arena and into a settlement conference, we can probably deal with it relatively quickly.
Bob, am I mistaken? Hasn't U.S. West taken some action and noticed they're going to with the commission to settle the case?
I've seen reports in the press, and I've heard been told by members of the commission staff that there's preliminary discussions to settle the rate case. Again, and I've expressed to the staff, I've expressed to U.S. West that I'm willing to sit down anytime, anywhere, in a settlement conference and talk about settlement. I would like to see that money get the customers. The concern is the first part of that is settling on a number. The second part is how do you then distribute that, and those processes, even if everyone's well-intentioned, can take time. I'm hoping they won't. But if you give people incentives to delay, I think it makes it less likely that there will be a quick resolution to that. But I would hope that we can get a quick resolution to that. So that's the first issue is the rate case. The second issue I don't believe that it protects the rates of residential customers. The last version of this bill had a price cap on basic local service and not on anything else. This bill has a price on everything else, but not on basic local service. So the end result of this bill, whether the price of basic residential service will go up 20, 30, 50, 80%, is unclear. And the way that works is through the universal service. It says to set the price up on everything except basic local service. And then the price of basic local service will be some new figure, some new benchmark rate established by the commission. The problem is once you set up price caps on everything else, they get adjusted downward for any increase in residential rates based on that benchmark. U.S. West will then have an incentive to go in and push for as high a benchmark rate as possible in that proceeding and turn that into a rate rebalancing proceeding. Because every dollar they can increase residential customers' rates frees up a dollar to lower the price caps of the competitive services, and they're going to have to lower those anyway. So, I mean, the way to look at it is U.S. West, through competitive pressures, will have to lower some rate as we go forward. The more that they can get those lower through universal service and shift it onto residential customers and increase that benchmark rate, the better off they are because they're not just their shareholders aren't giving up that money. Residential customers are putting in that money. And the other part that I think is unequal in the universal service is it says you establish that benchmark rate. Where the cost of service is above the benchmark, the company gets to draw on universal service. Where the cost of service is lower than that benchmark, and I believe that benchmark rate will probably be set above the cost of local service in urban areas. So where the cost is above that, customers will see a price increase. So we're raising all rates up to a standard that's not been established. And the reason for that standard is to deal with high cost, in my belief, is to deal with high cost rural areas and to set up a new way to support high cost rural areas without the implicit subsidy. I think that that's reasonable. I think that that's logical. But I don't think if we come up and say that the affordable rate for a rural customer is $20, and we're going to set up a universal service between, say, if the cost of rural is 30, between those two, that inherently means that a residential customer in an urban or suburban community has to see their rates go up to that $20.
Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, what you're saying, if I hear you right, is that the bill, as we're looking at it now in the dash five amendments, has removed the cap on basic service, and it's fundamentally different than the bill as it came out of the Senate. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes.
Okay, if I can follow, Mr. Chair. Can you specifically tell me where in the dash five amendments that comes to light?
Yes. On page four, that bottom paragraph, paragraph three, says the price a telecommunications carrier may charge for basic telephone service shall be subject to regulation and now shall not exceed the benchmark price established by the commission in implementing section 49. So it establishes this new benchmark rate. The previous bill said it's capped at current rates or what comes out of the rate case. This says it's capped at some unknown rate that will be determined through the universal service proceeding, and I believe this sets up an incentive for the universal service proceeding to become a rate rebalancing proceeding.
Bob, let me just jump in there. So you're suggesting that somehow U.S. West has some hold and leverage with the commission, that they're going to come in and be able to drive rates up? I mean, this is the very same commission which is beating U.S. West about the head and shoulders, and I'm just curious in terms of where you see that carriers are going to come in and be able, because you're arguing here that the reason why this isn't good language is because consumers aren't protected because there is no cap on basic service. Well, there's no cap on basic service today. It's gone through a rate proceeding. It would be a rate proceeding in front of the commission. It would take two of the commissioners in the future to set whatever basic telephone rates are going to be. I mean, you're sitting here arguing that, you know, that this is somehow onerous. It's the exact same world we live in today, except that we're creating a mechanism to take out implicit subsidies and make them explicit through a universal service fund. And I argue that this is the language which protects consumers, because the consumers will always have the commission there to protect them and to look after their interests as to how high and what the reimbursement rates are going to be for basic telephone service. So I'm just curious in terms of here how you're arguing that we can't trust the commission, basically, that they're going to come in and raise the rates.
Mr. Chair, I think you're accurate. I do believe that the Commission through the Universal Service Program will increase rates, I believe, by the legislature requiring that to happen on a short timetable, maybe increasing the time that that's going to happen, I believe, by requiring that rates go up to that benchmark, even where they're below the benchmark, even where the cost of service. The idea is to get rid of implicit subsidies. Why would you require that where the cost of service is below the benchmark, it go up? For a residential customer. I believe those things, yes, will lead to higher rates, and I believe the commission under this law will have very little choice but to do that. I will, of course, go into that proceeding and argue against that. U.S. West will go in and probably argue rates should be $20-$25, but it would be, I think, useful for this committee and for the legislature. One of the things we haven't talked about through this bill for the last several months is what are the real implications of the universal service section? What are the real implications of getting rid of the implicit subsidies and going to the explicit subsidies? And what kind of rate increases, rate shock, are we going to see on customers through doing this, this kind of approach? And I think there will be rate increases. I believe that. And I've had several conversations with commission staff. I'm trying to work up some numbers and try to get the I'm trying to get this committee some analysis of what I think those means in terms of rate hikes. At this point, I'm frustrated because I really part of what makes it difficult for me to support a bill that's this wide open is I don't know whether we're heading to a benchmark rate of $15. Or a benchmark rate of $20, or what it's going to be. I don't know if we're dealing with a 30%, a 50%, or an 80% increase. I do believe that this bill is heading us towards an increase in the cost of basic local service through that universal service fund. And we may get there anyway without this legislation, but I'm not sure why we want to try to speed up that process. I'm not sure why we want to try to mandate it. I'm not sure why we want to do it in such a way that even where rates are below, the cost of services below current rates, as I believe they are in many areas of the state today, that we have to raise rates up if we want to keep that universal service surcharge lower in order to subsidize the rural communities.
Bob, would you argue that the present system is a barrier to entry for competitors to come in to compete on the residential playing field because of how we set the basic telephone rates, and that by moving to a universal service mechanism, then all carriers who want to come in and compete are competing then on a essentially even playing field in terms of how they're going to be able to get remuneration for delivering the services, and therefore bringing competition into the residential area market sector in terms of which would and could drive costs down?
Mr. Chair, respectfully, no. I believe that the current rates in urban areas, which is where we would likely see that competition first, are above the cost of service. I think there are issues with access fees. There are structural barriers to entry. I think there's marketing barriers to entry. I think there's what I would call geographical barriers of entry, in that if you're going to build a line, you're going to build the line where there's the highest concentration, the highest number of phone lines coming off that mile. Phone lines are most concentrated in business areas, regardless of I know U.S. West says that the problem is business subsidizes residential, so it makes it easy target. Even if you equalize that in their minds, and again, I think residential customers in urban areas do pay the full cost of service, but even if you did, you still have the problem that a mile of line in a business area has thousands of phone lines off of it, whereas a mile of line in my neighborhood, and I live in a fairly dense neighborhood in Portland with 5,000 square foot lots, not quarter acre lots, you still do not have as many phone lines off that mile of line. So the cost, the recovery that a competitor will provide, it doesn't mean that it's below cost. What it means is they're going to target the areas that have the best and fastest return and are most concentrated. You build the first fast food restaurant in the state tends to go into a very populated, very busy area. That doesn't mean that they won't get out. That doesn't mean that there's not that they won't eventually get out somewhere else at today's cost. So I don't agree with that. I think it's a matter of time. But to me the key is I believe that the residential rates in urban areas do cover their cost of service. And admittedly, that's not something that everyone within the telephone industry in Oregon or everyone at the PUC agrees with.
So then Bob, in terms of your concern about basic telephone rates going up to cover rural areas, you would argue that we should not create a universal service fund which tends to keep all rates in Oregon the same? In terms of, are you arguing for a two-tiered system of rural areas where they will have higher costs because of lower density, should bear a different cost than urban areas?
Mr. Chair, if the goal is, and this is a goal that seems to have been set by Congress and other people, not by me, if the goal is to get rid of implicit subsidies and drive prices towards cost, and the cost is lower in urban areas than rural areas, then you have two choices. You either subsidize rural areas to the point that they come down to the cost of urban areas. And there it's a political judgment on the part of this legislature and the commission whether the level of subsidy it would take to keep urban keep rural customers down at that 1280 level is worth it. I'm skeptical. I've gotten so many complaints about the new E-rate and the federal. I'm skeptical that there's going to be the political will to charge the kind of universal service fee that drives rural areas down to the cost of urban areas. And instead, the Federal Act didn't require that. The Federal Act required the establishment of a new affordability rate and said we should drive rural areas, we should make sure rural areas get that affordability rate. They didn't say that we should subsidize rural communities to the point that they're at the urban cost of service. So, I think the Federal Act and the political realities of universal service will force us to do that. I don't believe that's the best policy. I've always believed that it's right to average costs between urban and rural areas, and that's how we get the best results. That's the best way, that's the way we achieve universal service, but now Congress has declared that that an implicit subsidy and has ordered us to get that out of our rates.
Thank you. Continue.
So I believe that that will lead to upward pressure on rates. In addition, I'm concerned that the way the price caps work, will over time put upward pressure on rates because they're not adjustable. The telephone industry is a declining cost industry. In addition, the demands, the usage of the telephone system, is increasing over time, which means the per unit costs, are declining. The end result of that will be that these price caps will never change over time. There's no mechanism for the commission 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, where telephone service is still a monopoly, to say, you know, this price cap we set back in the 1990s for caller ID is no longer the right price, that price should come down because that's no longer the cost of that service. And so there needs to be a mechanism where price caps can be adjusted over time to reflect the realities of the industry. And I'm confident that the realities of the industry will continue going down enough that I'm comfortable saying that the price caps can be adjusted upward or downward, because I believe that over time they will be adjusted downward, but there has to be a mechanism that allows price caps to be adjusted, or the alternative is to have some sort of productivity factor figured in so adjustments are automatic without having to go to the PUC. I know utilities don't like productivity factors, so I'm willing to settle for some mechanism that allows the price caps to be revisited over time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, it almost sounds like you're advocating for a continuation of a regulated rate of return. I mean, if you're going to start adjusting price caps up or down depending upon the economics of what it costs to provide the service, why don't you just stay with a regulated rate of return?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I think we've heard a lot about 40 states having price caps and the theory of price caps. The theory of price caps used by the FCC, where I think it really started in the telephone industry, was to adjust the price caps over time. And again, there's two ways to do it. You can revisit it. You can put in a productivity factor, but the price, and maybe it's better to do it as a productivity factor, so we don't have to revisit it. But if the prices are declining over time and you have some customers still subject to a monopoly and no competition, then those customers deserve some of the benefits of that declining cost. And the question is, how does the commission set those, as well as is the cost right now? Caller ID is up to about 30% of customers. Caller ID, call waiting, all of that share the cost of the local loop. If suddenly those services jump up to 70 or 80% of the market, suddenly you ought to be able to reevaluate how that local loop is allocated, because you have you have more contribution that ought to be going to it from those services than you would otherwise. So as services increase, the way we do the joint and common costs of the local loop and spread those out ought to be adjusted over time. That doesn't mean you have to look at the rate of return. And maybe you look at the various services that are done that are using the local loop, and you look at how you allocate the cost of that local loop, and you ignore their rate of return on services. But there's got to be some mechanism to revisit that, and most states that have price caps do exactly that. That's a part of a normal price cap regime.
Representative
Cummel? My question was asked. Mr. Chairman, can I follow?
Representative Witt?
Bob, then how do you separate if a telecommunications carrier is becoming more efficient in how it provides services, and it's under price caps, and it's not under a regulated return, its profits are going to go up, presumably. How does one then separate out the fact that it's become more efficient and it's become less costly for them to provide the services? How does one separate out their better business acumen, efficiency, which would lead to higher profits? Or would you would say that this is a service, this is an industry that has declining prices? I mean, it seems to me that there, you know, if you're going to take that approach, you better have some clear delineation so that the shareholders are able to keep what the company management is able to bring about through increased efficiencies. And because otherwise you fall into the trap that, hey, it's time to lower the caps because it costs them less to provide the service. It takes away the incentive for them to run their business in a more efficient manner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wood, I believe the price caps, by allowing them to keep the efficiency, and the purpose of a price cap is to allow them to keep the efficiencies for at least a set period of time. And that's why normally states say we will revisit the price caps. Normally it's about an every 5-year 5-year time, so that they get a guarantee that they can keep those efficiencies for enough period of time to get them the incentive to do it. Part of what we have to do is make sure that we're not getting so far away from the way the market would work. Under the market conditions, if somebody gains some efficiencies, the likelihood is their competitors do too, and the consequences are some of those efficiencies are kept by shareholders, some of those efficiencies are passed through to customers. And what we will have here is the customers where the telephone industry is competitive will see some of their price reductions. What I'm concerned about is the customers where telecommunications remains a monopoly. Residential customers, if the AT&T stuff doesn't work out, rural customers, that those customers also see some of the benefits of this declining cost, and whether it's declining cost of efficiencies or because of increased demand, technological change, to be honest, I don't think it makes any difference. In the marketplace, over time, not instantly, but over time, those efficiencies would flow back to the customer at some point. So I'm not really concerned where they come from. I think there has to be a mechanism that, some of the reduced costs over time come back to the customer. And I don't mean a yearly adjustment. And again, it may be a 3-year adjustment, maybe a 5-year adjustment. I know the governor at one point had proposed 2 years. I suggested to him that that was too much, that I don't have the resources to do a rate case every 2 years. And the commission in U.S. West and phone companies probably don't either. So I don't think it should be that quickly, but I think there does need to be a mechanism to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, doesn't, if the telecommunications carrier prices stay up there because of the price caps and the cost of service actually declines, doesn't the competitive market then come in and intervene? And namely, that competitive telecommunications providers will be able to step in and offer a better service at a lower price? I mean, isn't that the way to keep these prices competitive?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I think there's a problem with that argument in that if I'm a competitor, I may be looking at somebody whose service is overpriced and because they haven't passed on these efficiencies, and I may know I can go in and beat their price. But under this rule, they can immediately cut their price. So I'm going in to compete against somebody who has 100% market share in this community and has the pricing flexibility to respond to what I do day one. So I've got to make a significant investment in infrastructure. I've got to make a significant investment in marketing. I've got to make a significant investment, and my investment may well force the price down. But that doesn't mean that people will flock to me because the company will respond to retain its market share, may even be able to respond. And so the competitor has to look at, is this a market where that investment will bring enough of the market share, will knock them down from their 100% perch enough to do it? Not simply, are they overcharging customers? We see that regularly in the airlines industry. New competitors come in, the frontiers of the world, companies respond, lower their prices. Oftentimes those companies can't survive, and then prices go right back up.
We need to stand in recess. We are under a call. We are in recess until we'll come back after the call is lifted. We are in recess.
Until we come back.
Yeah.
All right.